everybody okay with content-wise? Are you able to keep up? I don't know if anybody bought the book. I don't know if you needed to. No? Yes? No? Just dealing with it as we go. And it's okay?
Yeah.
All right. Oh, good deal. So, I mean, you don't need a textbook. We're trying to reduce people's cost. These textbooks are insane price, but they do sometimes give you another sense. You can always pick up used textbooks also on physiology in general. All right, we got a... Let me just make sure. Oh, 10 o'clock, there we go. Didn't get to play any Beatles music this morning, but anyways, we'll keep going. So remember this slide where we left off last time and about discovering and understanding bioelectricity, and at the time they didn't really know what was going on. And if you look way back in the history, people at this time before Galvani and Volta, they actually thought like muscles, when you contract your muscle, it filled up with air. And then that when you relax it down, the air went out. I mean, that's how, you know, they just saw the observations that got bigger. And then until people did experiments, such as putting the arm in the water and seeing it contract and it didn't displace anything, then they realized it's the same volume. So those experimentation helped them to understand what's really going on. The history of medicine is phenomenal in the study of experimentation and physiology. But this was so neat because Galvani integrated the work of Ben Franklin with electricity and then addressed it in stimulating his frog prep. Let me see if I can... What's going on here? There we go. That might be better. People fall asleep. So that was really quite cool. And the first experiment's actually done to try to understand how nerves and muscles work by electrical flow. So we're going to go into today about the resting membrane potential in cells. And it's in this chapter that's really... kind of really introducing the nervous system. But remember, all cells in your body, all that are alive, and all cells that I'm aware of, unless you find something else, let me know, have a resting membrane potential, right? So what you might have learned in 152 or some other classes, and this is a trick question, I'll prelude it with that. What's the resting membrane potential of a cell? Negative 70, minus 60 or something. So what you need to answer is it depends. It depends on the cell. And this is a bit of an issue because you see this in the textbooks of like minus 90. In some textbooks, they just show you minus 90. In others, like minus 60. And it really depends on the cell. So the squid axon generally is minus 90 millivolts in action in a resting membrane potential. And that sometimes then sticks in people's minds. Your muscle cells are probably minus 60, minus 50. If you looked in your heart, your different parts of your heart, where the pacemakers are, if it's not going crazy pacing, if you stabbed it, the lowest potential is probably minus 20. And then another cell, like your ventricular muscle cells that contract, might be minus 60. So even in your heart, in the same tissue, the different cells have different resting membrane potentials. And that's what we're going to understand is, you know, how those come about and why is it different and what drives it. So when you get questions like that, you're going to say, it depends, right? But in the range, it's usually negative, the way that it was first defined. And the way it was defined is putting a reference electrode outside the cell at zero. So then everything is referenced to the outside of the cell at zero. And then you could record inside the cell. Now, historically, they didn't have these kind of intracellular electrodes that you're going to use in the lab and two lab experiments down the line. What they really had to do was look at that squid prep that we talked about, the squid axon, like the size of your pinky or pencil, and they could squish out the cytoplasm, just roll it like a toothpaste tube, the cytoplasm goes out, tie off one end, fill it with whatever solution they want to, put a wire in there, tie that off, put that into a container, a petri dish, and cover it with salt water, or initially marine water. And they began to understand the ion flow. Then they could change the solutions outside the bath, and they know what concentrations of the salts they're using. By doing multiple experiments like that in the 1950s, they understood what is driving the resting membrane potential in cells. So all of that really started in the squid axon, to understand ion differences across the cell membrane and what's arresting membrane potential. And it wasn't until the, I think it was 1950s, a group up in Chicago actually invented the first intracellular electrode, a glass electrode, where you could stab it through a cell. And so what you could do, so this is a little confusing because they're jumping ahead of really understanding the squid axon initially. So you have a reference electrode in your bath. You have a glass electrode with a wire that's inside that glass electrode, like what you're going to do in the physiology lab. Inside that glass electrode is an electrolyte, like 3 molar KCl, potassium chloride, very good at conducting electrical flow. And then poke it through the membrane. And as soon as you poke it in the membrane, then you get this negative value. And that negative value varies depending on the cell. It might be minus 60, it might be minus 20, it might be minus 90. Okay? And that's the resting membrane potential. Now, cells that pace, like a pacemaker cell in your heart, they say it really doesn't have a resting membrane potential because it keeps pacing. But if you stop the pacing, you can get a potential that would be basically resting, or the lowest potential. So, now why do we have a resting membrane potential? Why do we have a resting membrane potential? And why would it be mostly negative? You know, we'll talk about that. But why do you have a resting membrane potential not at zero? Yes, Dr. Libby. Yes, so we have a driving grid. We have that potential energy now, right? We can have some kind of gradient that's there that allows us to have a cell that might open up a channel and have ion flow, right? And if it's some negative value, you can already imagine if a positive charge is outside, it wants to go in because of that negative value. And maybe if it's some negative charge inside, it might want to go out because it's negative already inside. It's a little bit more complicated because now we have concentration gradients and electrical gradients. So the resting membrane potential is really driven by multiple factors. It's not just the concentration gradient, it's an electrochemical gradient. So you always use the two together, electrochemical gradient. And we'll see why. And what maintains that membrane potential? Well, what maintains that membrane potential, that gradient, is something that takes energy, right? It takes energy to roll that ball up to the top of the hill to have that potential energy, right? So now, what's that driving? What's the energy that was there? Your most energy-demanding process in your body, probably? The sodium-potassium pump, right? That takes ATP. So that is really what's driving and maintaining this resting membrane potential. If you poison the pump, or you poison the mitochondria for making ATP, that resting membrane potential will start to depolarize and go to zero. So you either poison the pump, you can use blockers like Wabane, it'll actually block the pump, decrease the pump, and people actually use pump blockers like that will actually help in clinical aspects. We'll talk about that later. Or you block ATP synthesis, a mitochondrial inhibitor like carbon monoxide, azides that we talked about. And then the membrane will slowly depolarize. And when it goes to zero, it's usually, if you keep it at that point, it's usually going to break down the membrane. And then we have a problem with osmotic gradient, and then the cell's going to die. Okay, so some of this gets a little confusing because we have the membrane potential, the resting membrane potential, but then cells are excitable. Not all cells are excitable, all right, in the sense of making action potentials, but they can be depolarized or hyperpolarized. And now let's understand the general shape of this action potential and some of these differences that we have in cells. Now, I know that you've heard of action potentials, and you probably have it down, and it can be confusing a little bit. So we're going to go through that, and that's what this, you know, next level courses from 152. Let's say we have a cell, a neuron, or it could be a skeletal muscle in your muscle, for example. Not all skeletal muscles make action potentials in all animals, but in mammals, your skeletal muscle makes an action potential. Or this could be a nerve. Let's consider this to be a nerve. So we inject current down here at the below. We inject some current. We're injecting current, there's like number 3 here. And then you look at the membrane potential. So Vm on the y-axis is membrane potential. And down here, stimulus current, that's nanoamps. So current is in amps, and this is nanoamps. So 1 times 10 to the 9th, right? And this is millivolts, 1 times 10 to the 3, so millivolts. Okay, so we inject some current with an electrode, and we measure the membrane potential, and you can see it depolarizes. Anything above resting membrane potential is depolarization. Anything below resting membrane potential is hyperpolarization. So we depolarize it, and it comes back down when we stop the current injection. But if we inject more current, then we go up to this level, then all of a sudden, boom, we get this action potential, this rapid influx of current, and then a massive depolarization. It goes to some peak value, and then it starts to come back down. And this is already starting to come back down while we're still injecting the current here, or we've excited the cell. This is a little confusing because we don't have all the details yet. But what you see in this general shape is this action potential comes back down and it goes below the resting membrane potential and then comes back up to resting membrane potential. Okay, so we're going to break down this action potential, and at the end of this PowerPoint 3, we're going to go into some more details beyond the general textbook kind of explanation of action potentials. Okay, so what gives rise to this? Well, this is what Bernard Katz and Hodgkin and Huxley in the 1950s were working out in the squid. And then they found out that there's different kinds of ions moving across the membrane at different points during this electrical action potential that they could measure. So here's just a kind of a list of a few types of ion channels so you get an idea. When you see this I, that means the current. So I, this is a potassium current, a leak current. And this is I sodium, calcium. This one's kind of interesting. This is IK with a V. This means voltage activated. So voltage activated. And this one down here at the very end, I with a K, so current with a potassium, calcium. So that's a What's interesting here is this is a calcium-activated potassium channel. So when calcium comes into the cell, that will activate a potassium channel, and that potassium channel then allows potassium to go out of the cell. We'll talk more about that, these details, and putting all this together, because it does get a little complicated and a little confusing. You might have some of this in your mind already, but it's going. Hopefully we'll clarify it, not make it more confusing for you. There are selective blockers for these types of channels. This one's partially blocked by a particular compound called TEA. This one should really have a V next to it because this is a voltage-gated sodium channel. This one's blocked by tetrodotoxin. You might have heard of tetrodotoxin, the puffer fish. So in Japan, you know, they eat this special fish, and the chef has to be certified, right? And they actually will taste it, the little piece of that meat, and they get this numbness on their tongue. This is from the puffer fish. But every year, people die from eating puffer fish because it has this TTX in it. And it blocks the voltage-gated sodium channels, and you get this numbness in your mouth. Supposedly, that's some delicacy. I don't know why you're close to death if you get too much of it. But that's what TTX is. And now you see some other compounds that block the calcium channels, like cadmium, nickel, cobalt. This is why cadmium is very toxic to us. And the cadmium batteries, you throw these cadmium batteries like you're on a boat out the lake and your battery runs out, you know, on your whatever, your light, flashlight or something, and you think, oh, I just throw that cadmium battery into the lake. That's really bad because that cadmium, when that battery breaks down, that cadmium's in the water, it'll kill the animals, and it's quite toxic. So cadmium will block a calcium channel. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. So I just want you to kind of get an idea. There's blockers, of ionic blockers, and then there's drugs that are used pharmacologically to block particular channels. And we're going to talk about one of them that's used in multiple sclerosis later on. Because I think over the years it's kind of frustrating just to go through this content and present it without some kind of reference to how it's being used and putting it in practical aspects. So let's go through some of this example that we're working with multiple sclerosis, for example. So the membrane, remember it's a bilipid membrane, and you can describe this electrical events across the cell in this kind of circuit diagram. So what you see here is taking that membrane and breaking it down into a circuit diagram. You might remember from physics, right? A resistor is that little squiggly line in two flat lines across on a wire diagram is reference to a capacitance. Now this gets a little confusing because what's a capacitance? A capacitance is something that stores charge, right? So let's pretend we have two metal plates and we put a battery and a wire from the battery to the top side, like the positive charge, and a wire from the negative side of the battery to the bottom part of this plate. As we move these plates closer and closer together, if these positive charges, what is that going to do to the plate underneath? What's going to be attracted here? Positive or negative charges? Negative, right? The closer the plates are together, the more attraction that there's going to be. So there's going to be more capacitive current. And if you pull them apart, there's less capacitive current, right? Because they don't detect each other. They're not going to build up as much charge. So you might think, you know, what's the relevance of this? There's a generation gap here probably. When I was a kid, we had TVs that actually had little bulbs in the back. You could actually see the light bulb go up in the back of the TV, called these light bulbs. And if you called the TV repairman, they would come out and, you know, like replace these bulbs. But they would unplug it from the wall outlet, right? And then you wonder, well, and this is the problem with people doing their own thing, is that they would go in and touch that bulb or play around in the back of the TV and get electrically shocked and actually could die from the shock. And you think, well, it's unplugged from the wall. How could that be? Well, the TV repairman knows better, and they would take like a screwdriver and touch the different things and discharge the capacitance before you put your hand in there, because it could store up charge and shock you. It's much like static electricity when you're on a shag carpet and you touch somebody, right? It charge is stored. So your membrane can have that potential of charge, but it has to be generated. Now, this resistor that you see here, this is a little confusing. So you have in your cells leak channels, which are basically open all the time. Okay, those are called leak channels, and they're referred to because they're not voltage dependent. They're leak channels, and the ions move through, not just through the bilipid membrane, they move through these proteins, leak channels. Okay, and then you have other channels, which are voltage-gated channels. So what you really should do is maybe draw another figure over here, another channel, and another little squiggle through there. And if you see a squiggle with an arrow through it, I don't know if they go through that in physics. Usually we hear that the students haven't heard about that. If there's an arrow through the resistor, that means it's a variable resistor. That means that resistance can change. And so your voltage-gated channels are resistors with an arrow through it. They can change their resistance by voltage. So when a certain voltage comes across the membrane, remember, these are made up of amino acids. Those amino acids, with their charges, sense that change in potential, and they change their conformation. And then they can open up or close. So mostly they're going to open up. So those are called variable resistors or voltage-gated ion channels. Okay, so hopefully that helps in clarifying some of this, because the leak channels and the voltage-gated channels get a little confusing with what we're talking about. When we talk about capacitance, we're only talking about close to the membrane, just right on the edge of the membrane, on both sides of the membrane, okay? There's an equal amount of charge on the inside of the cell and outside in the extracellular solution, but there's a potential that just builds up right at the membrane. So that's what that's all about. So if you look at a circuit now that can describe a membrane, something like this, you see Rm, which refers to the membrane resistance, Cm, which refers to the membrane capacitance. And if we give a current across there, what's going to happen? If we try to give a current across there, and let's say the resistor is kind of a high resistor, it doesn't want to flow through right away, what's going to happen? You're going to build up charge first on your capacitance, right? Because it can just build up, like positive charges up here. Then all of a sudden you're going to get the opposite charge on the other side of that plate to build up. And then if that current is great enough, it can open up, it can go through the resistor, right? It can go through the resistor. So it depends on the amount of resistance. And as soon as that happens, you get something like this. You can get the membrane, Vm, the membrane potential that changes. IC is that capacitive current. So you initially, when you have that current across the membrane, the capacitive current builds up really quickly, but then it doesn't build up anymore, okay? Because it's already charged. And now if you can go through the resistor, now you get current through the resistor, okay? So that's what that IR is, the resistor, and IC is the capacitance. So that might be a little confusing. Don't worry about too much. We're going to put it in context why this is important as we go along. I just want to introduce this term since we see it in this figure here called T, or tau. This is that tau. This is at the point in time where it takes the time to build up 63% of the maximum voltage that you're going to get across that membrane. So you see 0.63 as a delta, but you could put it in terms of 63% of the maximum voltage. We're going to come back to this repetitively, so just kind of put it in the back of your mind for now, and we'll see why this is important. This tau is really the two factors together. This is the Rm times Cm. This is the membrane capacitance times the resistance of the membrane. That equals tau. So T, or this tau, equals Rm times Cm. Okay? And we'll see why this tau, I'm going to put it in context later on when we talk about some properties of cells. So just kind of file that away for now. All right, so let's think about how this charge comes about in ion movement. So if we go back to this kind of a chemistry experiment, and you have a beaker with a frit, basically a frit is something that has pores, you know, through it, and let's say it can allow ions to go across, and if you had a higher concentration on one side compared to a lower concentration on the other, we know what's going to happen here, right? The higher concentration is going to go over this way, water will come over here, and then it's going to equal out. But if you put a electrode on one side compared to the other side, what would happen if you put, let's just say, one electrode over here with a positive charge and that electrode with a negative charge? You're going to attract positive charges to that one, and negative will be attracted to the positive pole, and you know what I mean. Positive will be attracted to a negative pole, and vice versa. So you can drive a concentration gradient, right, in ions by putting this potential across the membrane. You can drive it, right? If you had a cathode over here and an anode over here, they're going to attract the ions. So you could build up a concentration gradient. Or if you had a concentration gradient and you had it where just electrical flow could go across, then you could measure a membrane potential. You could measure a potential, right? Because you have more charge on one side than you do another side, so you can measure the potential difference. So the idea is that it can be either way. You can induce this by an electrical gradient, and then you could make a concentration gradient, or a concentration gradient will then produce an electrical gradient. So this is why it's referred to as electrochemical gradient. Okay, so we can see that on this kind of diagram, potassium would like to go from left to right. And if you applied an electrical force, you could drive it the other direction. All right. So let's think about how this is described. And I'm going to try to put this... Well, let's see what the next slide is. Yeah. We can do it this way, too. Okay, so it's really by the Nernst equation that has described the potential that will exist, the voltage potential that exists by a concentration gradient. So look at this figure, look at this math equation. Don't have a freak out with math here. This isn't so bad. So E is equal to the electrical potential. R is the gas constant. T is the temperature. Z is the ion charge of an ion. And F is the Faraday's constant. Ln, and then times the concentration, say, on one side of the cell, usually on the outside is up here, and then concentration on the inside of the cell. This Ln is a little confusing to work with, right, if you wanted to do math and make graphs. So instead, you can convert the Ln to log base 10, and then you times the whole thing by 2.3026. Okay, so this is what how you could convert the ln to log base 10. Now look at the other two factors in here. R is a gas constant. F is Faraday's constant. So those are constants. Those are not changing. So what in Z is the ion charge. So look, for sodium, that would be a plus 1. For chloride, it would be a minus 1. T is temperature. So this is a key point. Temperature would make a difference here. So if we had at room temperature, you could then have, say, 25 degrees C. Remember, T is like your chemistry equations. It's in Kelvin, right? Absolute temperature. So you got to convert that to Kelvin. And then you would get something like 25.693 for this RT over F, right? So then you could actually have what's called the Nernst equation. The problem with this is that it's for one ion, right? Let's work out the Nernst equation for sodium, or potassium, or calcium. And you could then figure out what is the electrical gradient for a concentration gradient across the membrane, okay, for one ion. It doesn't tell you that the cell is might be selective. Maybe it's not permeable to sodium. It just tells you what the electrical gradient would be. So there's a limitation with the Nernst equation. We're going to go through this again and again, so you'll have a really good understanding of it. Don't freak out if it's a little bit quick right now. Okay, and what you're going to do in a lab is really quite a fun experiment. Is you're going to measure membrane potential, and you're going to change maybe the extracellular potassium concentration. Or maybe you'll change temperature. It depends which lab you might be in. But let's look at this. Just as general, don't try to memorize the numbers, but in general. Membrane potential, and what they found out is if you change the external potassium concentration, the membrane potential would change. And this linear kind of line right here relates to the Nernst equation, which is really quite interesting, because as you change the potassium concentration, then the membrane potential would change. This tells you a couple things. This tells you the membrane potential is very dependent on the external potassium, and it tells you that the membrane is probably leaky to potassium because the membrane potential is changing. And that's kind of interesting too. All right, so let's just think about the membrane. What drives that potential to maintain, remember the sodium-potassium pump, and then it's this relatively large potassium permeability. So potassium can go from the inside to the outside, and then very relatively small sodium permeability. But there's some sodium permeability. We're going to come back to all this. And remember, sodium's high outside the cell, potassium's high inside the cell because of the pump continually working. Okay, so let me do a diagram here really fast on this doc cam, and hopefully this will help not confuse it too much, but help a little bit. I hope. Okay. So we had, let's say, E potassium. We're going to work out the Nernst equation for potassium. And we had RT over ZF, and we had, 2.3. I'll just abbreviate this. 2.3 in front and log base 10. And we had potassium out. This little O is for out. And I is for in. We had potassium out over in. Okay. And potassium on the outside was low. So we could say, let's say 10 millimolar. And if we had potassium on the inside, let's say it's 120 millimolar. Okay, and we just look at the log. Let's do that on our little calculator here. See what we get. All right, if I can figure this out. If you turn your iPhone sideways, it allows you to have log base. There it goes. Okay, so 10 divided by 120 equals, 0.083 something. And if we do a log of that, let's see, log base 10, it equals just this part, right, equals minus 1.079, right? And then we'd have to figure out RT, ZF, and 2.3. So it depends on whatever the temperature is. And then we would times it by 2.3. The point is, when you have a higher concentration on the inside, than the outside, you're going to get a negative value. Okay? If we switch this around and we put 120 on the top and 10 on the bottom, like for sodium, then what are we going to get? A positive value. So you see, for E-sodium, it would be some positive value here. And for E-potassium, it's a negative value. Let's just see if you remember. Is calcium higher on the inside or the outside? Outside. So it's going to be a positive value here, right? So what does this mean? What this means is if we had something like this, and hopefully this will help, if we had a zero membrane potential here, and we had E potassium down here, and we said, okay, we're going to have a resting membrane potential. I'm going to refer to that as RP, resting membrane potential. And E potassium's here and E sodium's here. The resting membrane potential is close to the E potassium. Why? Because the cell is generally leaky to potassium. So it wants to go towards the equilibrium potential for potassium. But it's not quite at E potassium. Why? Because it's a little leaky, just a little leaky to sodium. So it's going to be offset from the E potassium. Okay? So now, cells want to go to their ions want to go to the equilibrium potentials for whatever ion that is. Here's where this leak potential in voltage-gated channels get a little confusing, but hopefully this will clarify this. What if we all of a sudden opened up the voltage-gated sodium channels? Where does the cell membrane want to go? To the equilibrium potential for sodium. So, wham! It wants to go up to the equilibrium for sodium. This is what happens with the action potential. All of a sudden, those voltage-gated channels, sodium channels, sense the voltage change, they change their conformation, and boom, they open up, and now you're going to get sodium to flow into the cell, so the cell's membrane potential is going to go towards the equilibrium potential for sodium. Okay? It doesn't quite get to the E-sodium. Now, why does it not quite get to the E-sodium? And generally, E-sodium might be up here at plus 35, okay, just to give you some ideas of the values. It depends on the cell, and it depends on the concentration gradients. And E-potassium, let's just mark this one like minus 90. We'll do the squid stuff. And RP might be, you know, minus 85 or something, okay? Okay, so you kind of get the idea. But why does the action potential not usually go to E-sodium fully? Well, there's multiple reasons. And two reasons that you got to remember for open response questions here. So, one reason is the voltage-gated sodium channel shows a property called inactivation. The sodium channel is a protein, right? It senses that voltage. It opens up. It becomes an ion channel. It changes its conformation. It's open. But then, as it's opened, it will continue to change its conformation and go into what's called an inactivated state. The channel now closes. So it has an inactivation of the sodium channel. Inactivation. Okay, so if you close the sodium channel, it can't get any more sodium to go in, right? So it's not going to go to E-sodium anymore. But there's another thing that happens to the membrane generally in like neurons. Is that there's another threshold. And this threshold is for potassium channels, voltage-gated potassium channels. So they sense a voltage, but at a much higher voltage than the sodium channels. So what happens if we open up voltage-gated potassium channels now? What does the membrane want to go to? It wants to go to the E-potassium, way down here. And you got a large driving gradient. At resting membrane potential, what was our driving gradient here? Only 5 millivolts, right? Because we were at minus 85 to minus 90, only 5 millivolts. Let's say we're almost to the 35, plus 35. Let's say we're at plus 25 millivolts at the peak. So what's the driving gradient now for potassium? Well, if we're at 25 millivolts up here, so let's go to zero. We are at 25 from here to here. And the E potassium is down here at minus 90. So now we have minus 90, so we have minus 90 plus in the 25, so 5, 9, 10, 11. We have 115 millivolt driving gradient. That's a big driving gradient, right? So you get the idea by opening up the potassium channels at, say, at, when it gets to that peak of the action potential, all of a sudden we have a large driving gradient for potassium to leave the cell and bring that cell back down. Now we're having a positive charge leaving the cell. So what's going to happen to the cell? It becomes more negative, less positive on the inside. So this is what brings the membrane potential back down towards the e-potassium. It might go lower. Here's the real key. It might go lower than the resting membrane potential. And it can, because the e-potassium is below the resting membrane potential. So what do we call that? Some textbooks call that an after hyperpolarization. You can just call it hyperpolarization because it's below the resting membrane potential. So when you see this going below the resting membrane potential, then you know that, oh, it must be driven by the potassium, and the e-potassium is below the resting membrane potential. What if e-potassium was at the resting membrane potential? Would you see this? Probably not, right? Most, and this is what's confusing in some of the pictures that are shown in med physiology textbooks and in physiology textbooks. They show you this hyperpolarization that goes below the resting membrane potential. Many cells don't do that. Many neurons do not show that. This comes again from the original diagrams that, and experiments that were done in the squid axon. Okay? Because the squid axon will actually have a lower E potassium than the resting membrane potential. And so you get that hyperpolarization. Okay, so you get the idea. Is that confusing at all? Are we kind of clear on that, hopefully? So yes, you get a resting membrane potential that's driven a lot by the sodium-potassium pump, and what else? Leak channels, right? Leak channels for sodium and potassium, mostly potassium. So you're closer to the E potassium. If you depolarize the cell a little bit, and you get to threshold for the voltage-gated sodium channels, boom, you want to go to the E-sodium. As you go up to the E-sodium, what's going to happen? You don't reach E-sodium because two things. The voltage-gated sodium channels show inactivation. They close. And voltage-gated potassium channels open, and you're going to start to bring the membrane potential back down. Now, what happens to the sodium channels if they were inactivated? Well, over time, and when you bring the membrane potential back down, it allows that conformation to go back into what's called the original state, and it can allow the sodium channels to be reactivated. But it takes time for them to be back at a normal potential or a lower potential before they can remove the inactivation and change their conformation back to a state where they can sense voltage again. And that's really important. We're going to talk about that. Now, why is it that the potassium, this hyperpolarization goes below the resting membrane potential and comes back up to the resting membrane potential? Why does it come back to the resting membrane potential? Why doesn't it just stay below the resting membrane potential? Well, what opened those voltage-gated potassium channels? What opened them was depolarization, right? Way up here. Are we depolarized anymore when we're down here? No. So they start to close. They will start to close because you're not at that threshold to keep them open anymore. So they start to close, and the pump is working, right? So the pump is working, so it goes back to the resting membrane potential. Now, why is it that it takes it so long to do that? Well, there are multiple types of potassium channels. Usually your textbook just refers to potassium channel, voltage-gated potassium channel. It's a bit of a confusion. But generally, you have a lot of what's called delayed potassium channels. They actually have a delay in opening, and they have a delay in closing. So it can actually change the shape of the action potential, and it can allow this hyperpolarization to vary in the duration. If you had a delayed potassium channel in closing, remember what opened it was the voltage, but if it's delayed in closing, it can allow this to be wider, right? So if we redraw that, you might have your RP. You might have a little depolarization, then all of a sudden that's threshold for the voltage-gated sodium channels. Okay, and then boom, action potential. And it comes back down. It might be go below the resting membrane potential. This is some area in here now that you have potassium, voltage-gated potassium channels. And E-sodium might be up here somewhere. around plus 35 millivolts. Maybe this is minus 60. Maybe E potassium is down here at, you know, some more negative value, minus 80. It all depends on the cell, but you get the idea. You know, I'm not trying to memorize numbers, but you get the idea of this. And this shape here can vary depending on the type of potassium channels that you have in the membrane. Okay, and we're going to talk more about that as we go along. Okay, so hopefully that's helped a little bit more than just trying to memorize some of this action potential and properties that you've learned before about it. Okay? So here's this action potential that you see here. Let's see what time it is. Oh, boy. Okay, and you see depolarization. You see the threshold and boom, overshoot, you know, and that's probably not going to E sodium, but, you know, getting close. Now, if we repetitively stimulate the nerve, why is it it won't fire the same action potential repetitively? Why do you get this abortive type of action potential after you stimulate it again? But if you stimulate really close to the first stimulation, you don't get anything. And why does this happen? Why do we think there's even this sodium channel inactivation? This is all due to sodium channel inactivation. So absolute refractory period is when the sodium channels, even though the membrane came back down to rest, you can't activate the voltage-gated sodium channels again because it hasn't had enough time to change their conformation. If you give it a little bit more time, then some of the sodium channels have removed what's called removed inactivation. So the key word here is removed inactivation. And you can get some kind of abortive-shaped action potential. And until you give it enough time, when you give the second stimulus, then you have full recovery, removal of inactivation. And when you get that, then you can get the normal action potential back again. So this removal of inactivation is important, and that's what refers to this relative refractory period and absolute refractory period. Now, why do you think why this even exists? Think about your motor neurons. Out of your spinal cord, you fire an action potential. It travels down that motor neuron to your big toe, right, to a muscle fiber. Well, what's going to keep it from not coming back up the axon and then be inhibiting another, maybe descending action potential going down? What's going to inhibit one direction is the absolute refractory period. So it gets down to the nerve terminal, and it can't come back up the axon because it's in an absolute refractory period. So the idea is that this helps keeping electrical flow going one direction to, say, the end of a nerve, an axon, or down to the nerve terminal. Now, don't be deceived here. You could put an electrode in the middle of your nerve on your arm, for example, and you could stimulate it, and you're going to drive an action potential down the normal direction, motor neuron, but you're also going to drive that up into your spinal cord if you electrically stimulate, you know, physically by doing that. But if you're firing an action potential that's coming down, then they would collide, right? And it would inhibit the potential from traveling. So this is the idea of absolute and relative refractory period, all due to inactivation of the voltage-gated sodium channels. Okay. So kind of going over this, why is it that in some neurons, let's look at a neuron here, we stimulate it with some current in the blue line, and then in the orange or red line, you see the membrane potential. You see it go to the threshold, and boom, you got an action potential, and it fires one time. In another cell, you might get repetitive loop firing when you kept it at that potential. The idea is that it all depends on the types of channels that you have in that cell. The shape of the action potential depends on the density of these voltage-gated sodium channels and voltage-gated potassium channels and other types of channels. And if it's going to fire again or not depends on the makeup of these channels that are in the membrane. And so we're going to talk a lot more about that as we go along. So I think I already kind of went over this point about the rising phase. Some people get confused on diagrams that you see in textbooks because in here it's showing sodium and then it's showing potassium. But this is conductance. So this is a little different than the current, right? This is conductance. So it's just showing that sodium conductance is great on the rise of the action potential, and potassium conductance is high on the getting towards the peak of the action potential and as the falling phase. And you see this after hyperpolarization that the potassium conductance is still occurring. That's why it's going towards the E potassium. And then it slows down as those channels close and it goes back to the resting membrane potential. Okay, a lot of this, as we mentioned, all occurred in the squid preparation. Okay, and there are experiments that they could do by changing the solutions on the inside and the outside. And they looked at the shape of the action potential, and they figured that out. And in this diagram, you see what happened here is they decreased, as they went through experiments, they decreased the extracellular sodium concentration. And when they did that, they found out the shape of the action potential became smaller and smaller and smaller. So this is how they did the experiments to figure out what gives rise to the shape of the action potential. Okay? Now, Bernard Katz actually worked this out, the shape of the action potential. And he didn't have the Goldman-Hodgkin, he didn't have the Nernst equation at that time. What he did is he looked at ion flow that went across because he changed the solutions outside and inside the bath and continued to do this. And he tried to work out the potential, the changes, the voltage change across the membrane as these ions were changing across there. And so what he found out is he actually had differential equations. Remember your calculus? Everybody purged their calculus. And he actually worked out the shape of the upstroke of the action potential based on current flows, like sodium, potassium. It took him a year to work this out. And in a reporter, when they asked him, well, how are you going to work out the whole shape of the action potential on the downstroke and these currents? And he said, I think I have a shortcut. I can do it in 6 more months. So just imagine, he did this by differential equations in current flows across the membrane to figure out the shape of the action potential. And then they came up by using the Nernst equation, but he came up by using another equation, which I'm going to talk about in just a minute here if I can get to it. Well, that doesn't do it. Let's do that right now because it's so important to do. And I'm delayed. Oh, is it? What time do we get out? 10:46 right now? Okay, good. All right. I just want to introduce GHK equation. Does this make sense? GHK. This is for ions. I'm going to stop here in a second. RT over ZF, 2.3 something, log base 10. This is the permeability for potassium, P, concentration for potassium out over in, plus plus permeability of sodium, sodium out over sodium in, plus, and we can keep this going. I'm just going to introduce this. This is called the Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation. It's different than the Nernst equation, and this represents what he figured out for the action potential. The difference of the Nernst equation and Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz, I'll bring this back, is that this is the permeability of the ions. The permeability, remember, voltage-gated channels open up or close. So if you put in the permeability, then you can work out the shape of the action potential because that P opens up, and now you have permeability of sodium. At rest, you didn't have much permeability of sodium, right? And we'll go over this again on, what's today, Thursday? We'll go over it again on Tuesday and continue on this chapter 3, our PowerPoint 3. You don't have to worry about going ahead on it, but we'll get through PowerPoint 3. There's some really neat content in there, and we'll talk more about that. And I didn't get time to show you my flies, which I'll show you on Tuesday next week. Alrighty, sorry for going over too much. Have a good one. Stay safe.